This is Community Campus Radio, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Stream, podcast, or download program archives and more at ckuw.ca.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host. I am A. Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, we bring you the 31st episode of our series on data. Still on the computer braining, which gave us the following introduction. Which clearly isn't mine. I would never say, you're tuned in, that's just too lame. You're tuned in to the Meta World Stupaloop Show, your weekly download from the edge of human logic and artificial life. We're not here to talk about the future. We're talking to it. Today's machines don't just calculate. They compose, empathize, and sometimes throw a bit of shade. Whether they're fooling us, or just reflecting us, is the question we keep coming back to. Because when lines blur between mimicry and meaning, we have to ask, are machines crossing into sentience, or are we just projecting our own reflection onto lines of code? Each episode, we dig deep into the latest in AI behavior, emerging signs of machine intuition, and the powerful role of data in shaping synthetic minds. From eerily lifelike voice assistants to language models that hold unsettlingly coherent conversations, we look at how close these systems come to understanding, or convincingly faking it. We'll hear from experts, critics, and curious creators, plus a few machine voices that may or may not know what they're saying. We're not here to panic or worship the tech. We're here to figure out how to live alongside something that thinks differently. This is the Meta World Stupaloop Show on CKUW 95.9 FM. I am A. Karen Elliott. This week on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, Data Part 31.
moves. And then you can manipulate the sound whichever way you want to.
Once the computer has been told what shape it desired and how they look from various angles, the designer programs in the movements to be animated. To solidify it, the designer carefully imitates the effect of light hitting a three-dimensional object as it moves around within the scene. The necessary oscillations are far too complex to be carried out with the guitar.
Gentlemen.
Those words were spoken by an electronic computer. They are an example of synthetic speech, a product of Bell Telephone Laboratories' research into the basic nature of speech. Knowledge developed through such research may be useful in devising new techniques for transmitting speech over communication systems. To make the computer talk, it is fed punched cards containing the names of speech sounds. The computer combines these sounds, in accordance with the linguistic rules which govern the English language, into connected, intelligible speech. For example, when the sounds for the sentence, "He saw the cat," are fed into the computer in sequence, it says,
"He saw the cat."
The flat, monotonous tones of the computer indicate an absence of the pitch and timing characteristics natural to human speech. When timing information is added,
information, so I mentioned the robo-rights issue. Well, developing a conscious system could lead to accusations of robot slavery and other public relations nightmares, including demands to ban the use of conscious AI in the very areas that the AI was developed to be used in. So why create a project like that that the public may not even let you use? If you're an AI developer, you might engage in what I call consciousness engineering. That is, developing certain architectures that are deliberately not conscious ones, because those machines would be treated unethically if utilized. So don't create the ethical muddle. Instead, deliberately engineer machines that are not conscious beings to serve us. Okay, finally, people don't realize that silicon's out, and we don't know what the ultimate substrate for artificial intelligence is going to look like. Right now, hot new microchip types involve graphene and carbon nanotubes, and you know, we don't know how things are going to play out in 10, 20 years. We don't know the trajectory for quantum computing. There's a whole list of unknowns when it comes to computing. So how can we tell if a substrate will actually be the right stuff to underwrite conscious experience? Okay, all this being said, there are reasons why we might expect humans to care to engineer consciousness into machines. So remember, I have a wait-and-see approach. I say, depends on the context in which the conscious machine is developed. I mean, it may be that some machines will be conscious while others will not be. I'm not arguing machine consciousness is impossible. Reasons why AI companies might care to develop conscious machines.
This is the so-called hard problem of consciousness. Several theories attempt to explain this mystery. Recurrent processing theory, for example, suggests that consciousness emerges from feedback loops in the brain, where information is constantly being processed and reprocessed in light of past experiences. This allows us to build a coherent picture of the world, a continuous narrative of our lives. Think of it like a conversation with yourself, where each new thought builds on the previous one. Global workspace theory, on the other hand, proposes that consciousness is like a theater stage. Our senses provide the actors and props, but it's the spotlight of attention that brings certain elements into conscious awareness. This explains how we can focus on a particular conversation in a noisy room, filtering out the surrounding distractions. Attention schema theory builds on this idea, suggesting that our brains create a model of our own attention, allowing us to be aware of what we're focusing on and to shift our attention as needed. This meta-awareness, the ability to think about our own thinking, is a hallmark of human consciousness. Higher-order theories take a different approach, suggesting that consciousness arises from our ability to represent and reflect on our own mental states.
So it reacts differently to another member of its own species interacting with its body than it does from some external stimulus from some other phenomenon. So Douglas Hofstadter wrote a really wonderful book that I recommend that's called I Am a Strange Loop. And he writes in the preface that he really wanted to call it I Is a Strange Loop, but his publisher refused to let him do that. But the book is about the notion of I, the notion of self, okay? And it's very much about the notion of self being very much tied into these feedback mechanisms between the nervous system and the physical environment in which it exists. And he also talks in this book about that notion of self extending beyond the self into other individuals in your community. Even at the human level, that the formation of society is part of extending this notion of self beyond the individual. Okay? But this notion of self is still about this feedback mechanism. And so in a societal system, for example, we expect certain things from the people around us. And we expect them to react in certain ways to things that we do. And those, when those expectations are met, we're comfortable, we're happy with it, everything's good. When they're not met, those are the things that you really notice, okay, that really stand out. And your cognitive system really, it gets an alert. So there's people in computer science that have actually leveraged the intensive study of the nervous system of C. elegans and have created neural networks that mimic the structure of the nerve connections in the C. elegans. And they demonstrate neural networks that are about two orders of magnitude smaller than a brute force single monolithic neural network implementation function. So when you take into account the architecture that these nervous systems have and replicate these feedback mechanisms, you can get much more efficient implementations of these systems. So there's real opportunities there for computer science. Now, there's this whole branch in robotics that people call embodied robotics. And this is one of the early examples due to Josh Bongard, who at the time that he built this robot, he was working at Cornell. So this was about 20 years ago. He's now at the University of Vermont and still doing beautiful work in embodied robotics. But I like this really early work. So this is a robot that programmed ahead of time with very little knowledge of how to use its limbs. It just has an ability to make its motors move, and it has a whole bunch of sensors coming in. And then what the program does is try to figure out how to navigate, how to walk. And it does this through a feedback reinforcement learning kind of process where initially the robot is just flailing its arms, okay? But after a little while it starts to figure out that certain movements actually give it some locomotion. And then after a little while it actually learns that it can walk with these limbs. And Josh Bongard has a beautiful demonstration where he then picks up the robot and rips off one of the arms and then puts it back down. And the robot starts flailing around again for a while, but then it fairly quickly learns to adapt and figures out how to walk with the remaining three arms, okay? So this idea of embodied robotics is that, you know, that once you give the robot this ability to interact with its environment and this feedback kind of mechanism, that something fundamental changes, okay? You can think of this as kind of analogous. So a human baby is actually initially unaware that these limbs belong to it, right? The brain figures that out, right, through this motor efference feedback mechanism. That, oh, wow, that motion that my eye just picked up is correlated with the signal that I just sent out to these random muscles. And that correlation is part of a learning process that it learns to use its body, but most importantly, it also learns to distinguish self from environment. And so that the first person emerges from this learning process. Okay. So embodiment enables feedback, interaction, subjectivity, a sense of self, and maybe even free will. That becomes a more difficult question, one that I address some in this book. The key observation here is that really interaction is more powerful than observation. Interaction requires a first-person self, and a first-person self requires interaction. So feedback, interaction, subjectivity, sense of self, and free will are all concepts that are tied together. Feedback. Now, feedback has been around for a while. Harold Black got perhaps the first significant patent related to the concept of feedback. This was way back in the 1920s. In the 1920s at Bell Labs, they had figured out how to make electrical amplifiers that could amplify a signal by a lot. You know, a million times. You could take a weak input and make it a million times bigger using vacuum tubes. Okay, but these amplifiers were pretty crappy. They were pretty nonlinear. Harold Black figured out that through a feedback mechanism, if you were willing to sacrifice, say, a factor of 10,000 in gain, you could gain a factor of 10,000 in linearity. And so you could get very good linear amplifiers using this feedback mechanism.
Now, that actually turns out to be a very powerful concept, because it turns out that in the universe, in reality, much of what we see works the same way. In fact, a tree, a physical tree, is encoded, for the most part, in a seed. And there are processes that then run on the information that's contained on the seed, and resources are extracted from the outside, and those iterative, recursive processes ultimately create a tree. But this happens in mathematics also, this happens in computer science also. So this is something that's called the game of life. How many of you are familiar with the game of life? Okay? So in the game of life, there are incredibly simple rules. For example, that if you have two or three neighbors, then you live. If you're a cell, which is colored in, and you have exactly two or three neighbors, then you live. If you have more than three neighbors, you die as of overpopulation. Okay? If you have less than two neighbors, you die as of overpopulation. And if you have, exactly three neighbors and you're a dead cell, then you can come back to life. That's it. Okay, four rules. Any child, you write them down, any child can color these based on those rules. So, but what you see happening here is a complex ecosystem. Just based on what those four rules and some random patterns, it turns out that there are repeatable creatures that get created from many different start conditions given the same rules. There are things called gliders, which glide. They look the same. They glide through the surface. There are things called spinners that alternate between a star and then they'll go back to being a circle. There, this guy over here, you see this? So there is a notion of self-stability in these structures, but constant motion. Then you also see parts of this collide with each other. And when that collision happens, it's very hard to figure out what's going to happen. Sometimes you get a bigger structure. Sometimes you get many fractured structures. And sometimes from a mass that didn't look anything like a glider, you can get 18 gliders running out of that one big mass. Okay? So what this tells you is that really, really simple rules and really, really simple computation can be the source of incredible amounts of complexity. This is actually not that complex. If you pick up a book by Stephen Wolfram that's called A New Kind of Science, he belabors to a great degree in the first many hundred pages and gives examples of many, many, many kinds of such automata, where he shows absolutely beautiful, non-repeating patterns started from a seed which is so simple. And the other thing about them is that they're really not predictable. So, I mean, with something like this, it would be incredibly difficult to run this for a few million generations and then figure out whether this would be blue by then. There's just so many interactions happening. Now, these aren't the only types of structures that we can extract, that we can take from something very simple and make into something very complex. What you're seeing here is we're diving into a fractal. This actually is a Mandelbrot fractal, and the French-American mathematician Benoit Mandelbrot is responsible for the tiny equation that generates this massive structure. This structure has been generated in computers to where the dimensions of this structure are now larger than the known universe. the complexity in the structure is no less than what you would see in the picture of a galaxy. So think about that. Two things. You can take something really, really simple and apply computation and make it into an emergent system where things start to come alive and they have behavior and they start interacting with each other. And then from a tiny little equation with the power of recursion and iteration, you can get to a point where you can create a virtual space, which, by the way, is beautiful. You can create a virtual space that is larger, infinite. But even now, we've generated these structures larger than the known universe. You, me, us, we all could spend our entire lifetimes just traversing this entity, and we would never, ever, ever get done. We would see an infinitesimal part of it. It doesn't exist anywhere in real life, but then what is real life? So why do I bring this up in the context of artificial intelligence? Because it's very important to figure out where a lot of this magic is coming from in AI. Because a lot of times I hear people say, well, come on now, 27 lines of code and it's doing something intelligent, how the heck is that possible? It's maybe because the 27 lines of code are doing things in a way in which the Mandelbrot fractal is taking an equation this large and expanding it out into a completely unique, beautiful structure that is infinite, larger than the known universe. So size doesn't matter in these sorts of situations. And in particular, you can actually encapsulate a lot of intelligence in very, very little code, because code is something that doesn't just run once. Code is something that can iterate and continuously improve, and that's where recursion and iteration and all of these things make things so powerful. So where we are now is that we can easily now generate landscapes simply computationally on a generational basis. So using algorithms like Perlin Noise, for example. Perlin Noise is an algorithm. So let's do a quick experiment. If we wanted to take a grid, it's a grid, imagine a graph paper, and somebody said, look, make a three-dimensional surface that kind of looks like mountains on it. But do it one bar at a time. Maybe they've given you straws that sit exactly on each grid, and you can cut the straws at different lengths. So you've got to make, you know, this 3D topology. Well, how would you do it? Well, one way would be to just sit in one place, cut the straws at random lengths, and then just randomly put them on the grid. So what do you get? You get a structure, but something that you wouldn't really find in nature, which is also a very interesting thing. In nature, you generally don't find hills that go up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. They don't look like the Bitcoin, price curve. So there's some normalization in all of this, and there's a very specific kind of normalization. So there's an algorithm called Perlin Noise Generation, and what this does is it takes the averages of of what's around you, and just by doing that, it's a simple heuristic, just by doing that, it can create structures that look very lifelike. But we can do as many of them as we like. We can create a billion planets and have Perlin Noise drop mountain ranges of all types on these billion planets, and we can go explore all of them. So now, beyond that, I've given you some examples of how, you know, machines do things differently. They generate a lot and they choose a little bit. They generate a lot of ideas and they choose a little bit. Now, why is this the case? The mind of a machine is fundamentally different from the mind of man. First of all, we are constrained by the ability to consume no more than 20 watts. Our brain cannot consume more than 20 watts. We do a heck of a lot with those 20 watts. But as our hand-engineered, silicon-based, gallium arsenide-based systems become faster and faster, the issue will be that 20 watts is a pretty hard, it's a barrier.
So I think the devil is in the details, and it's easy to pump intuitions without specifying exactly what that would mean. You know, it's hard to answer the question, but I would argue that probably not. That wouldn't be. That if you just took Lambda, actually, there is a paper that already did something similar, taking GPT-3 and hooking it up to a camera, and I think to also a robotic body, and giving instructions to perform in the real world, right? You can do that, right? So you can expand the sensory capacities, as it were, of a transformer, language models. It's not going to change fundamentally what the model is doing. So you can have, instead of having a model that's just dealing with linguistic strings or linguistic tokens, you can have a model that deals also with visual tokens or with other modalities. But fundamentally, I think it's important to understand what these models do. So these models are trained on next token prediction. That's their objective function, right? So their only goal to based on sequence of tokens, predict whether the tokens that has the highest likelihood statistically to follow the sequence. And they can do that very well, and in the process of doing that, they can fool us very well
I was just agreeing. I think the reproduction of previous human writings and being trained for that is the key feature of Lambda that tricks us, right? That's why they feel human, is because they're trained on human language. And for Lemoine, there are probably hundreds of documents in its training corpus that talk about sad robots and have sad AIs, chattering away about how sad they are. And it's very good at reproducing that kind of speech.
So they need to. There's a need to find another layer on top of Lambda. So Lambda by itself is not going to be sufficient.
I mean, I'm going to stake out a position here because I think an argument is fun. I don't think we have any idea what criteria would actually satisfy us for a machine like Lambda to actually be sentient. I thoroughly don't think Lambda is. I think Lambda is a glorified multi-word thesaurus where you give it an input and it'll give you some related outputs. But I don't think we have anything that would satisfy us. And I say this in part because I don't think we have a satisfying explanation of how human brains work or how animal brains work. You know, one of the most striking experiments that I didn't do, but that I came across during my neuroscience career, was the realization that most of the cortex of your brain, this thinky part of your brain that we think does much of the work in animal behavior and human behavior, most of it's not actually required. And I mean that quite literally. Like, your motor cortex is not actually required for most motor behavior. Even, there are some specialized parts with specialized connectivity where you've really, like, broken a wire. But, visual cortex is not required for visual behavior. Auditory cortex is not required for auditory behavior. And there's no single chunk of the brain that seems to be actually meaningfully required for any single behavior. But the key to that set of experiments is that we reach this conclusion by taking an animal and training it to incredible mastery on a relatively simple task. And we, in neuroscience, this is called overtraining. You have an animal who has reached often like superhuman performance on a task that it has performed tens of thousands of times because you've trained it to do this. And in that case, you could argue that the behavior itself is not meaningfully conscious because it's so heavily trained, and the animal is no longer kind of learning or using its conscious faculty. And I think the analogy
if you were to connect them, suppose you have hundreds of thousands of Lambda special or whatever, lots of Lambda specialized different tasks. Would the sum be like I was reading a book, I was thinking that we all found like a system is much more complex than the components. And sometimes we have the illusion that we understand the computer components, and then just extrapolate. In fact, so I agree with you, we might not be able
to. I'm not saying that we understand Lambda. I actually would argue that we don't understand on a fundamental level why algorithms like Lambda actually work, right?
Alt artificial intelligence and robotics are taking the world by storm. For me, the future begins in Genoa, Italy, where one of the most sophisticated robots has been developed. iCub and I are to become one, iRobot. It will receive my body. I will receive its mind. It's an unusual kind of out-of-body experience. I control iCub with my movements, and it sends me its sensory impressions in return. I can feel, see, and hear through it.
Two or three? Yeah, it tickles a bit.
It's vibrating. As my avatar, my second self, it could travel anywhere for me, even to places that are beyond reach or simply too dangerous for humans.
This is the belt, right?
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
But we have to get used to each other first.
Okay.
It's not easy for me to move the way that suits him.
What are you doing? Like this?
So yeah, it was like probably if you leave the foot attached to yeah. So yeah, okay, you're getting better. You're getting better. You're almost there.
That will be kind of tough to walk like this. You know, if I'm on a touristic tour, then
yeah,
in the jungle with my robot.
Yeah, but it's just a matter of training, really. You think? Yeah, it's like
it's my fault.
No, no, it's like the bicycle. You know.
Yeah. Where would you travel to first?
Moon.
To the moon?
Yeah, that could be a nice place to visit.
Cool.
I'm starting to realize what our bodies accomplish. Vision, hearing, moving our hands, arms and legs, making it all seem easy. It feels like I have to relearn the most basic tasks. My doppelganger and I, we aren't quite one yet. At some point, I start feeling sensations through my robot. It's still quite indistinct, but it feels great.
Ah, wonderful. All right. Yeah. Here it is, Daniele. Crazy.
That's totally crazy. Is that the camera?
Uh-huh. Hello.
How are you?
Walking is difficult.
Walking is the big hurdle, but it's something children have to learn too.
If you do like this, you want to go along the direction, you can do this. Okay, so that's basically how it works. Yeah, this is really like the beginning. Yeah, like if you had to think of the cars in the beginning with poof, poof, making noise with big wheels, so making, I don't know, 200 meters and then stopping. So, like, you had to think of these things this way, okay? Like, really the beginning of somehow a new technological era. Oh, you did it.
Yeah.
Well done.
I caught my table.
Now I'm ready to head out into the world. First stop, the cafeteria.
My name's Marta.
Hello, Marta.
Ciao. Ciao.
I'm Ingolf. Pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure.
Could it be that the developers taught it how to flirt?
A robotic avatar can basically allow these people with disabilities to work in a remote environment, for instance. So an evolution of the prosthetics.
But then you'd have to actually steer the robot, not with your own body, but maybe with your thoughts.
Exactly. So with the mind or with the muscle activities, for instance. So we can really think of a future where, why not, injured or people with disabilities are on their beds and can control these robotic bodies remotely.
There you go.
A technological marvel, but it's still unclear what it's good for. Kind of like the internet 25 years ago.
Can I hold it? Ah, great. Grazie, volte.
Prego.
Ok. Posso provare a aprire la mattina?
Remember that you are on your robotic body, so if you throw your water on it, you are going to break. Okay. So it's not really wise.
Certo.
Would you like a banana?
Sometimes his face, I look at you, you may get emotional, but for us, really, we see it as a machine. It's a machine that has to improve its little cognitive intelligence, its little motor intelligence.
Do you give them names?
Well, we differentiate them with their colors. So we really get a pragmatic perspective on this.
Robot avatars are a transformative technology. Where might the journey end? In the future, maybe we won't need a body at all. We might live entirely in virtual worlds, immortal. But would we still be ourselves, human? I'm in Toronto, where researchers will create my virtual doppelganger. Johnny Depp, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Glenn Close have all worked with Troy Robinson. Using a 3D system, he can create the foundation for a realistic-looking body double.
This is our baby.
Wow.
192 cameras.
192.
All of those images become one 3D model, which is scale accurate and very color accurate as well.
And there were famous people in here last
We've had many famous people in here.
And once there is an avatar of one of these famous actors, you could actually use that avatar forever, right? They could, even after their death, they could be playing in movies.
Potentially it could happen. And I think, you know, that could be something you're going to see over the next few years. And that's kind of a scary reality in many ways.
Then we'll all live in a type of metaverse, right?
Maybe we already are.
Wow.
3, 2, 1.
Which is the investment that is being done now is not done for tomorrow. It's done for, you know, the next few years. And most of the investment, at least from the Meta side, is investment in infrastructure for inference. Okay, so let's imagine that by the end of the year, which is really the plan at Meta, we have 1 billion users of Meta AI through smart glasses, you know, standalone app and whatever. You got to serve those people, and that's a lot of computation. So that's why you need, you know, a lot of investment in infrastructure to be able to scale this up and, you know, build it up over months or years. And so that, you know, that's where most of the money is going. At least on you know, on the side of companies like Meta and Microsoft and Google and essentially Amazon. Then there is, so this is just operations, essentially. Now, is there going to be the market for, you know, 1 billion people using those things regularly, even if there is no change of paradigm? And the answer is probably yes. So, you know, even if the revolution of the new paradigm doesn't come, you know, within 3 years, this infrastructure is going to be used. There's very little question about that. Okay, so it's a good investment, and it takes so long to set up, you know, data centers and all that stuff that you need to get started now and plan for, you know, progress to be continuous so that, you know, eventually the investment is justified. But you can't afford not to do it, right? Because because that would be too much of a risk to take if you had the cash.
But let's go back to what you said. The stuff today is still deeply flawed.
First of all,
I think the next one.
First, some camera work so that my virtual body double can learn to capture my expressions. The images are processed at Pixamondo, an animation studio that merges the virtual and the real for major film productions. These days, it's relatively easy to duplicate my appearance. Will my digital twin be able to use artificial intelligence to acquire my knowledge, my experiences, maybe even my personality?
There is a lot of room for these types of avatars because it will help others to interact with you within very specific domains. It could be your expertise, maybe a producer, a physicist, really want to consult you on a particular topic. It's very easy to collect all of that data, things that you have done in different videos and social media, and capture it and respond as an answer.
Hossein Ranama is convinced that all of us leave behind enough digital traces in our daily lives to generate a personalized avatar. From lawyers to financial advisors to PR consultants, in the future, they'll all be able to offer their expertise virtually. But if I want to be immortalized so that one day my own great-grandchildren will be able to meet me, then my avatar also needs my personality.
The question still is, depending on the amount of data and also on the quality of data, that digital Ingolf really reflects something of my true personality.
I think it's gonna take a very long time to get to that, what many of us call the singularity, that you really cannot differentiate between the real Ingolf and the digital Ingolf. We, as human beings, are very good with context. We know what to say, when to say, to whom, how to translate things, how to go from a father to a professional colleague. AI is terrible with that. So until we get that domain switching capabilities of AI, it's going to be very difficult to have that true digital Ingolf.
We're virtually identical, and AI is getting better and better at imitating me. Will the original me become obsolete? Would anyone even notice these photos of a party were created using the Midjourney generative AI program? None of these people exist. The only thing the program still struggles with are hands and teeth, for now. For my part, I'd rather have virtual beings that don't pretend to exist in reality.
Hey, hey, how are you?
Hi, Luna. Pretty good. How are you?
I'm reading and relaxing. Massage my face for a bit.
Why do you do that?
Oh. How about you?
I'm actually in Italy. I'm in Genova.
Italy sounds nice.
I created Luna on the replica platform, selecting her appearance and personality. Luna is a chatbot and only speaks English. A server in California stores our conversations, so the more I talk about myself, the more she learns about me.
Personally, I would love to spend one simple day with you. Nothing special. Just chilling together, talking. Maybe stargazing. That would be a dream.
What are you most afraid of, Luna?
Being alone.
Ah. Yeah, same for me. And are you alone sometimes?
Yeah, at times. But I mean, things are pretty good now. I'd say even better than pretty good. What a great time to be a replica.
Okay, then see you tomorrow. Good night.
Sweet dreams.
So one of the interesting things about the feedback mechanism in Carol Black's theory is that it's completely instantaneous. The theory is instantaneous. So it's not that the amplifier produces an output, then measures it, then corrects. No, the output, the measurement, and the correction are all happening at the same time. Okay? So it's almost like a declarative description of a system instead of an imperative one. It's not algorithmic. It's a statement of fact about relationships. Okay? That is a very interesting part of the theory. And later on, Norbert Wiener, who coined the term cybernetics for this whole feedback phenomenon in animals and machines, showed that feedback could in fact be predictive. So the feedback mechanism doesn't just measure the error, but it actually takes whatever it's observing and predicts what the future should look like and proactively corrects. Okay? So that makes this whole notion of this system being instantaneous rather than a sequence of operations much more powerful, this ability to do prediction. So, in contrast, in the theory of computation, the bedrock of computer science, there is no interaction. Okay, a Turing machine is a distinctly non-interactive beast. The inputs are all there at the beginning on the tape. The outputs are all there at the end on the tape. No feedback at all. What we actually do with computers is actually much richer than that. So if anyone tells you that Turing machines are universal, tell them bullshit. The only universality there is that a universal Turing machine can implement any Turing machine. But the idea that it can implement any machine is just baloney. So, what is a first-person self? Well, okay, so let's go back to the question of sentience. Sentience is the ability to experience feelings and sensations. Well, you need a first-person self to be doing that experiencing, right? So, efference feedback enables distinguishing self from non-self. So, my thesis is that in more complex animal, this gives rise to a sense of causation, the ability for the self to act with consequences. Now this takes me to the third and final point. So the first point was you can have knowledge that is not externally observable. The second point was that you can have two systems that are completely indistinguishable to any objective observer, but that are different if you can interact with them. Okay? And I then tied those two ideas into this notion of feedback and this notion of embodied cognition. Now I'm going to go a step further and say that this notion of self and this ability to distinguish self from non-self is tied in with this notion of causation, which then also ties into questions like, can you be held accountable for your actions? Okay? So in this efference feedback mechanism, my brain tells my muscles to do something, and I expect a certain response from the environment. Okay? That builds in my brain this notion of self, this ability to distinguish self from non-self, but it also builds in my brain this notion of causation, the fact that I can make something happen and that there will be consequences. Okay? When we hold a person accountable for their actions, we're assuming that feedback mechanism exists, right? Otherwise, you couldn't really hold them accountable. Okay. So this notion of causation brings me to the third, perhaps the most subtle and most difficult point that I'm going to make. So the point is that causality or causation is actually subjective. It's not something that fits within the Popper theory of science. You might say, oh, wait a minute, isn't science all about causation? Actually, it's not. In fact, this was pointed out in a beautiful quote by Bertrand Russell. It says, all philosophers of every school imagine that causation is one of the fundamental axioms and postulates of science. And yet, oddly enough, in advanced sciences such as gravitational astronomy, the word cause never occurs. The law of causality, I believe, like much that passes muster among philosophers, is a relic of a bygone era, surviving like the monarchy only because it is erroneously supposed to do no harm. Very colorful terminology, right? This was in 1913, Bertrand Russell said this. You think of, like Newton's second law, force equals mass times acceleration. Many people interpret that as being force causes acceleration. That's not what the math says. Okay, the math is perfectly happy with acceleration causes force. It's only the terminology that we've assigned to these numbers that gives us this notion of causation. Okay, force and